So we thought we'd start the discussion. We are about 10 minutes behind schedule, which isn't too bad, really. We thought we'd start the discussion by asking Zoe how she came to make the three films that we've seen. Because as I was saying this morning when we were chatting about this, when you see three such very odd movies, you want to know how they managed to come into the world. And especially something which touches on, as I said in my introduction, Zoe's multifaceted relationship to her work, the importance of writing, drawing, design, film, and so on. So, Zoe, can you tell us a little bit about how they came into being and a little bit about the quite complicated process of making them?
Well, I guess I started kind of to seriously kind of engage with Brecht. You know, I started to think like he was somebody I wanted to invite into the conversation was during the 2008-2009 financial crisis. And I felt, originally I was thinking about, I guess the first work that kind of struck me at that time, he did a play called St. Joan of the Stockyards, and in which he explains how the stock exchange works. And it's actually very practical. And I thought, like, this is really great. It's like, you know, people are being thrown out of their homes, all this crazy shit is happening, and, like, we should really understand how it works. So then I was thinking, you know, and on top of that, he spent time in America, you know. Maybe America would be a good place to ask him some questions. That was when I started to think about that, and being occasional, I live in New York, but occasionally I had trips to Los Angeles, and I was just thinking, it's so strange to think of these European emigres in Los Angeles. It's such a strange kind of configuration. So I started to think about it then, and that's when I started to kind of really dig into Brecht, always remembering in the back of my mind this Eisenstein and Disney story that, like, somehow I didn't know how this would work. But kind of I was in the midst of this, and then, as Laura said, the Occupy movement happened, and Occupy Wall Street is actually very near where I live, and I started to spend time there, and then that kind of blossomed into the Commune Project, which I felt was urgent to do at that moment, to kind of think about Occupy in relation as a kind of occupation like the Paris Commune, of a place where working people took over their city. So I wanted to do this kind of rehearsal for a commune yet to come, kind of in dialogue with Brecht's play. Then I came back to this project, and again, I was floundering. I didn't know how to get into it, and I kept reading about all these films that never got made. I was like, that's so interesting, but, like, I don't know what to do with it. It was like I was stepping on the idea because I just didn't know how to deal with it. And then I got, Laura knows this story, I got invited to take part in a show at the Cinémathèque Française for the 100th anniversary of Henri Langlois. And I thought it would be really interesting for me to work on maybe an archive of cinema that never got made. Like, we always talk about, like, restoring films or archiving films, but what about the great archive of films that never went beyond a few scraps of paper? Don't they need their archive? They need their space too. That's kind of like cinema's unconscious. So then that's when I started making Glass House. Unfortunately, before I could finish, I was actually uninvited for that show. So but then I was so deep into it, and I knew right away I wanted to do both. Because it would be kind of like an archive. I would do Glass House and Model Family because they were both kind of dealing with architecture as a kind of metaphor for talking about society. So I conceived of both of those at once, and it was really a question of making those films.
So Zoe, I hadn't understood. So you actually thought of Glass House first, then New Model Family, and then you did two Marxists.
Two Marxes was, yeah, really to introduce the story as a way...
I hadn't realised that.
Yeah, to tell people who these people were.
I see, yeah.
So they have to be... well, I mean, they work alone, but in a way, ideally, all three...
Yeah, ideally, they're a set of films.
Okay.
Because I think it's really important not just to talk to an audience that knows, and that's kind of where I wanted to make... Two Marxes to kind of introduce these my characters.
But then you introduce them in quite a curious way with the choice of child actors. And I suppose if I could go on just to ask something, because clearly there's a lot about Brecht's critique of Hollywood, the commodification of culture, but there's also a lot methodologically borrowed from Brecht, or Brechtian techniques worked in there. And I suppose, are these all elements of defamiliarization, models and puppets and child actors?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I really hate, like most historical kind of dramas, they try and get actors that really look like those people. And it always seems to work out, almost always, kind of like they end up looking like bad waxworks.
If I can interrupt you, just remembering how Vertov hated Eisenstein's October because he said the fake
Lenin.
Yeah.
I agree, the fake Lenin is a bit of a problem. And I love that film, but yes, I could do without the fake Lenin.
But then you have a choice, don't you? Either you go for archive and document, or you push the fakeness in, or you acknowledge, you bear the fakeness, or you make it very visible.
Which is what you're doing with your Disney and your Eisenstein head and
box on the head.
And,
you know,
and the children.
The children, yeah. Mm. But I felt the children, it kind of came to me, the children, and I felt like what I liked about the children was they had a kind of boys of that age, they were 12 and 13, they have a kind of optimism, but they're old enough to be serious, they know what they're doing, and, you know, they're the next generation. I wanted to present it as an idea that doesn't look back, but goes forward. Boys are learning. I feel like all artists should be learning. They're learning about the world. And so I felt like in this now over optimistic moment that these young boys would be a good people to put this idea forward.
But in a way, that's a, it seems to evoke another Brechtian technique of the way he, the learning plays that he did with his ensembles of actors, that they're learning. It's not so much about representing for someone else, but going through the process yourself and learning through it.
Absolutely. I felt like if I couldn't teach these boys like how to be a Brechtian actor, who Brecht was, for example, then I had failed. And they should be learning. And I my husband joked with me because I was, especially to the boy who played Brecht, who was very smart, we would talk about Brecht and his ideas and how the bankers were swindlers, and Eric was always like, are you just turning him into a socialist? But how could I not? And they had homework where they had to go and watch Chaplin's The Gold Rush. That was their homework. And they were very surprised that something so old was so funny.
Which I suppose brings us to another theme, which I suppose is also Brechtian in part, about without humour, no dialectics, and the role of humour, which I think is spoken about in one of the films as well. So, because in some ways, you know, what you're alighting on is intensely miserable and difficult, and but as you say, you want to, or at least at that point, you felt there was possibility of optimism and opening it out. But, I mean, could you say something, I suppose, about the use of humour, the use of sort of comic strip, popular forms, the use of animation. I mean, that seems to be embedded in a lot of your work in general, but also in these films.
I think one of the things, many things that attract me to artists, at the time that Brecht and Eisenstein were working, really in the first half of the 20th century, was this idea that you were a radical artist, and yet you were also working ideally for a popular audience. I mean, when Eisenstein made his great films, he made it for a mass audience. And the idea that, radical artists like Mayakovsky were above, they were not above working for a mass audience. In fact, they wanted to work with ordinary people. And I think that's an idea that we have very much often lost today. Mm-hmm. That you should be generous and you should work for lots of people, and that includes both thinking and also entertainment. And so, I mean, I'm personally attracted to working in popular forms. Comic strips are important to me. Animation is really great, even though my animation skills are stuck in about 1909, but enough. I think their interest in kind of the variety show, the sideshow, the sketch artist thing, I think is really great, and it's not an either or. It doesn't mean you're not, I mean, you being radical is also being, should be, in the ideal world, should be popular.
But this is something that was very characteristic of that moment of Eisenstein and Brecht in the 1920s, which to a certain extent we lost sight of in, to go back to the so-called radical 70s, there wasn't very much humour around. Now everybody's laughing. But I think that was something that was so important then, that mixture of popular culture, entertainment, and turning it into something else, which I think you've got. I mean, speaking of Zoe as a medium, you've got a kind of contact with of that.
And I think the high art world still looks at that kind of thing with suspicion. I remember once I had an invitation through somebody to go and talk to somebody at MoMA PS1 about the Commune project, and I was explaining to her what I was doing with activists and amateurs, and we were performing this thing on the street, and she just looked at me and she went, well, why would an artist want to do community theatre? And yeah, it's like I could have been like talking about doing The Sound of Music, and she quickly ushered me out without looking at anything.
I think we'll come back to some of these things. So I just want to kind of cover some of the ground. One of the things that I like about, well, all of the films, but particularly perhaps about Two Marxists in Hollywood, is actually the cinematic structure that you've put into it and how you put layers, literally, onto the screen with your own painted backdrops, because you had to, as you say, you had to act as the producer of the film, you had to paint the backdrops yourself, you also had to deal with the mothers and the teachers and the carers of the children who are under Hollywood rules of appearing on the screen. But I think the way in which you use layers of images to suggest layers of time. I don't know if there's anything else you'd like to say about that.
Because that was just like, again, it was kind of an idea that came to me, and it was a very simple structure, because I wanted them to exist in two times simultaneously. I mean, it's that simple. In the time that they were there and in our time. And both, now I look at it, are strange. I mean, even like the contemporary world around on the outer frame, it seems so unreal. I mean, and I feel that, like, Los Angeles is a very strange place. Coming from Europe, it's a very strange place. And I remember Eric saying to me, why don't you just use a photographic, like historical photographic backdrop? And I said, no, I have to paint it. And in part because I wanted to reference scenic painting, like in in the 30s or the 40s, if you looked out of a window in a Hollywood film, it was scenic painting. It wasn't real life.
Yes, and of course it rather reminded me of my own personal obsession with rear projection as well. I mean, it's like a kind of Brechtian realization of the rear projection illusion as well, until you then reveal the illusion by pulling the camera back.
So it's a sort of picking up on Los Angeles as a city of sort of flats and
exactly everything is kind of like a strangely painted backdrop.
So in a way, it's not just,
and it's very theatrical. It's very set up.
Yeah. So it's not just temporal. I mean, there's the temporal reference of the two times, but it's also something about the illusionistic capacity, I suppose, particularly of film, its potential illusionistic capacity, and how that's been concentrated in Hollywood, I suppose. And
I was very influenced by, now here's a kind of higher reference, but for a long time, by this film made by Straub Huye called History Lessons. I don't know if anybody knows it. It's based on a Brecht novel called The Business Deals of Mr. Julius Caesar. And it's not an easy film to watch, but I think it's incredibly rewarding. And you have people in Roman dress in contemporary Rome being interviewed by a young man in contemporary costume. And so you have this kind of past-present thing happening in which the Roman bankers and so on are talking about empire and the beginnings of capitalism and the role of slavery, and but seeing how power is grounded in economics. But it's done in this, like, the past and the present, and then it has these long, never-explained driving scenes through Rome that punctuate it. And that, in part, gave me a lot of ideas, because I'm interviewing these people who, from this other time. But also, the tracking shots, for me, are very important, without the actors, through to Marxists, because I wanted to convey a kind of economic geography of the city. So you have very wealthy areas, very working class areas, you know, the entertainment industry, the port city, that are kind of the fabric of this.
But just to make one other comment about the time, when you were making it, you were putting, you had your present then of your shooting time, the production time, and the past that you were referring to, the Brecht and Eisenstein's past. But of course, when we watch it now, your time, your shooting time is of the past.
Right.
And there are various ways which I think that the film puts that in. I suppose films necessarily put their own present, in inscribing their own present, they're also inscribing their own past. So when you put the hip-hop DJ Rapture in, you're also acknowledging a completely other side of Los Angeles, the kind of African-American culture of pop and Los Angeles, which is in a sense the invisible to Hollywood, and the invisible side is brought in. But also, I found it, you know, very poignant when you have the radio weather
thing. It's a really weird feeling in me, that weather report.
Because it puts you literally in that moment when they were shooting, which now is so has now faded into the past. So I think that gives us a kind of immediate uncanniness of film, and the way that film, whether we like it or not, is constantly reminding us of the time rolling forward, and so putting those different other kinds of layers on top of the perhaps more obvious layers that you put in.
Although, I mean, in a way, they may be picking up on that, because I'm so intrigued by the idea of the uncompleted films, the films that never got made, and then your differing efforts to go back and reactivate or actualize in in the present something that was missed from the past, and that in a sense also counteracts that sense of the past has disappeared, the melancholy and the lostness, because then you open up the archive to future possibility, and there's a sort of openness and a non-chronological notion of time. So, I mean, is there embedded then in both, say, both the projects of Model Family and Glasshouse, a kind of a reactivation of possibility, I suppose?
Well, you come to something that I've been thinking about for a long time, and I'm really struggling with, because it will be actually part of the next project I'm doing, which you know really well, which is Benjamin's concept of history, which is like super important and really, really hard. But I think which suggests that the past is never dead, it's never still, it's never gone, it's still with us, and it's always open to change for better or for worse. And I think that's really something important. So, you know, for better, we can connect with something in the past and bring it forward, like these lost films, in a kind of a positive way, that will change what they were, because they're no longer failures. You know, they're being written like kind of like when you say something's a failure, then you just close the book. But there is no reason to do that. We can make it not a failure.
That's precisely the point I was trying to make in my introduction, but I couldn't, at that moment, I couldn't remember your exact words, which then come in the introduction to the film, when you said, perhaps these utopian projects are not failures, but merely lying in wait. I think we should open up to questions and discussion. We can carry on and pick things up, Esther.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to know if there are any points that people would like to bring up immediately. Volker.
Thank you very much for those wonderful films. There's these two archival films in A Model Family and A Model Home, and one of them, or maybe even both of them, take us back from 1941 to 1935, 1936. So to the New Deal, when there's this collectivist way of dealing with things, and then there's the individualist way of dealing with things. And I was interested in, were these particular films references that you had come across, and then it was just about finding them, or was it part of a larger archival research?
That's a really good question. Both those films date, actually, those films themselves are pretty much from the 1950s. But yeah, they reference a New Deal, the first one, because that's when...
So can I interrupt you? So do you mean the one about the farmers' electrification is in the 50s?
That film was made in the 50s, I think. That was a... But still to promote this electrification, I mean, there are collective... If you have a farm or live in the country in America, more than likely you belong to an electrical collective. My husband's brother lived in rural Missouri, belonged to an electrical collective. I mean, these things that started in 1935 were still very, actually, quite active. But that's a really interesting question, because it's how I work, which is I scavenge. I'm not so much an archivist as a scavenger, and I scavenger of popular culture, and that means I've collected home movies for a long time, often on different times in my life. And the films that Laura referenced, the Coney Island Amateur Society Dream Films, were all made from home movies from this collection that I have.
And is it true you found them in the street?
Not in the street. I found a lot of flea markets.
I was romanticizing it slightly.
It was a flea market, and now it's the great flea market in the sky, eBay. And so I was, I think you just learn really, really, like, things speak to you, and you learn from surprise. Like, I'm a flea market scavenger because then things grab you and speak to you that you aren't expecting. So at that point, I was looking, I wanted to find an Ohio farm family for the Model Home film, and I found that beautiful footage, which isn't that family, but does it, you know, it's a farm family from Ohio in 1939. And I was looking for anything to do with home. So I was looking at films on eBay, just, it's very tedious, but you look and you look, and things that just strike you that I never would have thought of those films. And then I found them, and they immediately fitted into a question, the collective or capitalism. So it was like they built the story.
Mandy.
I was very struck by the reference in your Glasshouse film to the future and surveillance. And it seems to me of the triptych that you gave us today, the one that takes us into the now and the future, when you think of the CIA investigating the Russian surveillance of Hillary Clinton and Trump replying mm-hmm. that the CIA is also investigating him and so forth and so on. When I was doing some research on Eisenstein's adaptation of Dreiser's American Tragedy, mm-hmm. I thought about that argument of the indifference of the people in the glass house. They can all see each other, but so they just don't look. Yeah. And it gets rougher later on in the account. But the kind of notion that you can just get used to surveillance and you can become indifferent to it.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you might comment on that, or if you were thinking about that in some future way, because it's quite noticeable this week since the terrorist attack in Westminster, that there's a big call here for more surveillance,
mm-hmm.
and the argument is that now encrypted social media will have to be de-encrypted
mm-hmm.
by the companies that provide it to protect us from these things. And broadly speaking, the agreement's going to be, the public here will be, yeah, fine.
Mm-hmm.
This is the most CCTV country per capita in the world. So in America, it's different. There's Snowden, there's things like that. I wondered how you saw the future of this and how you would look at it cinematically.
I mean, when I made Glasshouse, that was just at the moment of the Snowden revelations and all that was happening. Like, that was 2014, so it was very topical for that. And I was kind of interested at the end. I mean, you know, Eisenstein is talking about optical surveillance. And now I've written that, you know, if he'd lived for 10 more years, he would have witnessed the birth of Sputnik. And with the birth of Sputnik came GPS.
Yeah.
And a whole new kind of surveillance. And it's something that is clearly on everybody's mind today, obviously. And our country, the country I live in, shall I say, we're dealing with this kind of crazy Russian thing happening. And I know a lot of people in Europe are really frightened of Russian interference and whatever, hacking. So yeah, it's we're in the thick of it. What do Americans say? People have really differing opinions. It's a very hard thing to make a film about because it's invisible, you know. It's something. It can't be, like, visual surveillance is a visual thing.
Yeah.
But
Sue, go on, sorry, Sue. Yeah.
But digital wireless surveillance, it's hard to graphically represent what cannot be seen and yet is ubiquitous.
One moment. No, go on, Jean. You.
Just, would you say, because this idea of you being a medium, is that in a... Because I think I read, when I saw this online, that there's a kind of porosity between the living and the dead. And I wondered whether you meant medium in that sense, or whether you meant it in the sense of we live in the post-medium condition, you know, and that you might be a kind of...
Mm-hmm.
Phenomenological trajectory in which certain things. I just wonder whether you could
I use that term medium kind of playfully.
Mm-hmm.
I say playful, and as playful, it references a lot of things because
yeah.
I am certainly, you know, not mystical or spiritual. It references the idea of a spiritualist medium
mm-hmm.
who can conjure up the dead, but obviously I'm an atheist, sort of materialist
mm-hmm.
medium. But I do think, in some way, imaginatively, to be an artist and do what I do, I talk to people in the past. Mm-hmm. That's I mean, it's literal in the films, but it's really how I think. A few years ago, I gave a lecture, and this Harvard historian came up to me afterwards and said, "What's your methodology?" Mm-hmm. Nobody's ever asked me that before, and I said, "Well, you know, I just talk to people in the past." And he looked at me like, "What?" But it's the way I think. And also, I think it's, you know, I think academics work on people, like they work on Eisenstein, but I would rather work with Eisenstein. Mm-hmm. That's how artists work.
Great, yes.
It's a question connected to that, really. I'd like you to talk a bit more about scavenging,
mm-hmm.
and the idea that whether you're scavenging with intent in relation to a specific idea, or whether you're, as a practicing artist, you're scavenging on instinct and you think, oh, this might be useful, but I don't quite know what for, which kind of flies in the face of like a research methodology.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in how you balance the two sides between effectively practiced as research and coming up with something that's very rigorous, but your starting point might be somewhere else.
That's a good question, but to me, it has very practical implications called storage space. Like, if you scavenge stuff, you have to store them somewhere. And in New York, storage space is in short supply. You should see my office. About 20 years ago, I was going to the flea market every weekend and buying any 16mm home movie I could find, sight unseen. I could usually tell it was a home movie, and I would have the fragments of all kinds of people's lives. And I've been sporadically using, then I stopped doing, the flea market kind of died because parking lots have become high rises and flea markets have gone online. And there's part of me that still scavenges dreamily. But often more now I scavenge with some general thing in mind. But like I say, with those films, I could never have looked for those films. But when I was looking in kind of a broad way, the film, I found them, and then they gave me ideas that I would not have had otherwise, which is a bit different from, I think, some researchers who they're looking for a very specific thing. Because I can, yeah, things, I mean, that's one of the things I love about finding things, is they have their own lives and they tell me things. Mm. You can't totally twist their arm. That's why making the dream films was really great, because that home movie footage, they were telling me stories.
Mm.
I just had to listen to them.
Mm.
So you also have to be a listener to what you find.
Well, I think it's interesting, Glass House has such a very different feel because it is so constructed and,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, controlled in a sense. I mean, there's found footage.
Yeah. But it is totally structured, you're right. But Eisenstein structured everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he's picking up.
He drew everything out first and he constructed, it's constructed. And that's kind of... Like, I was taught to make films like Eisenstein, draw everything,
right.
Really graphically work it out, and it kind of came out of that.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like storyboarding.
It was really storyboarding.
At Columbia.
Pardon?
At Columbia.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was taught filmmaking by somebody who had worked with Eisenstein in the 40s, and he was really a Russian formalist.
Who was that?
Stefan Scharf. He was kind of an amazing, amazing professor, which most students were way too intimidated by to work with. Mm. So I would be in the class of like two people. Mm-hmm. And I realized he was completely brilliant, and like even though he would like get mad at you, why not work with the best? But yeah, very formal, had to draw everything. Really thought about film as a language.
I never knew that.
Yeah.
I never knew. Right. And he'd worked with Eisenstein in the 40s.
Yes, and I wish I knew more, but I was so young. You know, I didn't think to ask him, like, lots of questions.
I know. Isn't it awful?
It's really annoying.
Yeah.
But he would show these Eisenstein films, like, at the beginning of every semester, you know, and talk at great length, and shot by shot, and...
Mm. Yes, I think that's most unusual in film training...
In America,
today.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. It was then. I mean, most people were really not into that at all.
Yes.
That's why there was like two people in his class.
So was this film school or art school?
This is Columbia.
Columbia was film school.
So it was a film.
Yes. It was a film training to be a film director. Yes.
Okay. It's quite a big film school. It has Miloš Forman.
He was there.
At some point. Any other points, questions anyone would like to bring up? Jean, yeah.
Could you say how you work? I'm interested to know, because you work with your partner, and I just wonder whether you work at home, where your archive is, where how much you do every day.
Well,
I'm just, because you work like an artist.
Well, I'm just, what I do is I make, this is just where I lose money. I'm a college professor. I teach at Queen's College. I teach, in the media.
Queens, which is part of the
City
New
University.
York
CUNY.
Yeah. City of New York system.
Yeah, so I'm like a regular college teacher. I work with young, mainly working class undergraduate students, and I teach people to make their first videos and record sounds and drawing wand and, you know, very practical things. And that's what I do, and that's how I make a living. And my studio is just in our apartment. New York's, it's very expensive. I can't afford a studio. I joke about how I have storage space in every borough, but actually I have some storage space in the Bronx. My office is a storage space. I have some storage space at home.
So do you work on a steam back or?
Not anymore. I used to. Mm-hmm. I totally used to work. I used to have my own steam back, but... Now I'm afraid I work on a computer. Mm-hmm. I still sometimes shoot film, like Model Family is all shot on film, because I wanted to make my own material kind of consistent with a lot of archival material in that. But the other two films were shot in a modern way with digital cameras, so I work on the computer. But yeah, I have small grants, research grants, stuff like that.
Lily?
I'm just curious, wondering if you can throw things away when you've made a film about them. As in, you're making films like this, is a way of processing these things that you pick up that you're either kind of wittingly or unwittingly looking for.
Mm-hmm.
But then you don't have to store them anymore because you process them and you've put them out into...
No! Some things... because they might tell another story. They mean they
okay,
might have something else to say.
So you keep them?
Like a lot of the old movies, I do keep them actually.
Yes.
I mean, then I did like this, you know, and sometimes I once got 60 films all at once that this business school was throwing out. That became that project, The Eternal Dream of Mutt and Jeff.
Mm.
I mean, cultural history was crazy, like... so interesting. Again, I wasn't expecting that, but that kind of came with that. But sometimes I have used things more than once and quite differently. It's like, that's what I like about these unfinished things. It's like, any one of you could make your own glass house and it would be really different to mine. They are very open. It's like, once an artist like Eisenstein, he's finished a film, nobody else is going to make his October. But you could make your glass house.
I was wondering about that veracity as well, because you said in your intro about, you know, because when I saw those three films in New York and they were displayed with the archival or very convincing fact similes of the archival documents from the Eisenstein archive, and you said in your introduction, in a sense, you want people to know about the veracity of these materials, so that's why you might include that extended work alongside wonderful paintings and drawings and so on. And in some ways, maybe also holding on to the film footage is about holding on to these documents and to say, this didn't all just come from my head, or it's not all just a reconstruction or a fantasy, but it exists in the material. And, you know, there's more to it. It's in the world and from the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like exhibitions that do that, often that have, like, archival material and artist work. And I like it with the things like Eisenstein's drawings for Glasshouse are amazing and really beautiful. And I just want people to see them, but also to show that it is some kind of... you can make your own determination about the kind of dialogue that I set up. So,
Anything else, anybody? Because I want to say a couple of things. And then I think we'll start... You know, we can see if we have any last points, and then we can move on to... our last section.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to really just to point out something that's very obvious in Two Marxists in Hollywood, which is that Eisenstein and Brecht were there for very different reasons, in that Eisenstein was traveling. There was still a sense of a future in the late 1920s. Whereas when Brecht was in Hollywood, of course, he was there as an exile from fascism. And I just feel that there's something about that end of the 20s moment when you bring up the importance of the imminent coming of sound. And one of the things that Eisenstein was interested in when he went to Hollywood was to find out from the greatest technicians in the world how they were managing it, what they were doing. And of course, he must have been extremely disappointed that they weren't... Well, there were some early sound films that were quite interesting, but then they went into what was a completely abhorrent to him, which was just literally sync sound as dialogue, with musical accompaniment.
Theater.
Yeah. So I just feel that in those two films you get very much a different sense that Eisenstein could go to Hollywood, however much he was shocked by it. He could go there and see it as something that was industrially and popularly interesting. And he was in this very, very last moment of utopian modernism, and was then going to travel to Mexico and make his Mexican films. So it was something you were mentioning this morning, that and then there's that very witty bit in the film about him, Chaplin, recommending his analyst.
Yeah. Which is true, by the way.
And Chaplin going through this speed analysis. And how this was a journey of unrepression. He was losing something of his repressed nature. Whereas I think when Brecht went there, he was so much a fugitive. There was so much less possibility. I just wondered if, just from a very general point of view, if you could just comment on those different historical moments and expectations.
Yeah, well, I think you've said it very well. I mean, Eisenstein went, he was invited by Paramount Cinema. Mm. I mean, he was a international movie sensation with Battleship Potemkin, and he thought this would give him kind of carte blanche to try even more amazing and fantastic experiments. Whereas they said things when he got there like, well, could you make something sort of like Battleship Potemkin, but cheaper with Ronald Coleman? You know, which really was not what he was planning to do. You know, they saw a blockbuster, and he was doing something really different. But he really loved, you know, Griffith and Chaplin, and there really did seem like possibilities to do something really special. He did not... he was not against Hollywood cinema.
Mm.
Whereas Brecht, yeah, I mean, he just went to completely different circumstances, and I think after he was just kind of traumatized, and just after like the horrors that he saw and that his friends dying, and I think there was something he felt very, I felt reading about his, like, he just felt really, it was very guilty. It was like, it was too nice. It was like, it was all wrong. It's wrong. Like, the world is in crisis, and, like, it's sunny in Santa Monica. Like, fuck that, you know? That just, it's all just felt totally wrong.
Mm.
And I think he only gradually, and I wanted to suggest that, only gradually did he start to see some interesting things, and he learned some interesting things, and he got to meet Chaplin, who was like one of his heroes, and he realized that people weren't all bad.
Mm.
And
is it, does it, it's Brecht who tells the story about the screening of Monsieur Verdoux.
Yes.
And that he and Chaplin were the only people laughing.
He and Hans Eisler, yes.
He and Eisler.
People,
yeah.
Yeah. And he had some.
Oh, my friend Hans, that was
yeah.
it. Yeah.
It was, but he couldn't work the way he wanted. He couldn't make his theatre. You know, English wasn't right for him. But there was something nonetheless about this idea of working with a popular audience, for a popular audience, I think that nonetheless intrigued him. I just remember having this. When we did this show in New York, there was a panel, and we invited, very few people were invited to speak, including a Brecht scholar who was not anything like Esther Leslie, who we discovered when he started speaking, he hated Brecht.
Who was this?
Some guy at Hunter College, like somebody, nobody ever after that confessed who invited him. And he was just railed against Brecht, and one thing he really railed against was Brecht didn't meet the American public halfway. So, you know, which it was just like, whoa, like he didn't become like a second rate Broadway playwright. But yeah, he wasn't that goodness. He didn't do that. Neither of them did that, obviously.
I think we might just move on to the, because I think what we'll do is ask Zoe, she's very kindly agreed to give us this preview of her work in progress.
Mm-hmm.
And we can look at it, and then we could kind of come back and mm-hmm. discuss it at the end in the context, I think, also of the film, so that we don't move kind of right away from our
yeah.
topic this afternoon. So, Zoe, would you like to say a word of introduction of the context of the new work and how it relates to the topics we've been, the films we've been seeing and the topics we've been discussing?
Sure. Mm. Well, it's always hard to talk about work you have yet to do. but I have, like, tons of ideas and this that follow on from this, but really differently, because I think something has changed. And I think I'll start by saying, you know, when I made The Model Family, and there you see like the Ohio farm family and the people who live in these faded subdivisions, there's something I felt very warm towards, like the American farm family. But you have to remember that the American farm family today voted for Donald Trump. And that's, and so did the people in the subdivisions of St. Louis, and all those people, they voted against their own interests. And things have really changed in America, I think. I mean, I find it really kind of shocking. And clearly it didn't change as well. It's just this kind of xenophobic race hatred just has erupted across the country. That was clearly there. And that's one thing that I want to come back, why I'm so interested in this concept of history, because history is not dead, it's never finished. So these things that were there, but we thought they were gone, are all there, out in force. And so I felt, realizing this fall, that I could, this was became very, very apparent, and I felt like I had to deal with that. Because it really is kind of like it's a crisis. You know, we're now having to worry about our students being deported and their families being deported. This is not kind of an abstract academic idea. So this happens, and then just to context the work I'm working on right now, I was also invited by the head of the Brecht and Benjamin Archive in Berlin to take part in an exhibition that they are putting on in Berlin in October about the friendship between Brecht and Walter Benjamin. And so, of course, I have to say yes, because these guys are my friends, my heroes, you know, my comrades. But I also said that everything that's going on in America must be front and center, and it is completely relevant to their discussions. And only their work that deals with things that I think can help us today is what I want to deal with. Now, they were having a lot of conversations mainly in Denmark between like 1934 and 1938. And so they were dealing a lot with fascism. And so how can we think about fascism then? How can we think of fascism in America today? So that's become kind of the subject matter of the work that I'm doing, which again has to be popular. It has to speak to people. And so I'm going to show you some things that I've been working on, and there is going to be a film that I've been writing the script on my travels, and I'm planning to shoot it this summer, which is a dialogue between Brecht and Benjamin in New York today. But naturally they won't be played, as you can imagine, because it's me, by two middle-aged Germans. So here's my thinking, but I'm allowed to change all of it, because this is not a film yet. It's just in my head, yet to be realized. But I've been thinking actually about, okay, so how can we think about these people who were refugees and migrants then? Obviously, Germans in New York really doesn't make any sense. So how can I get the right feeling and spirit? And I have a couple of actors in mind. I don't know if they are going to be able to do this. I would like Benjamin to be played by an African-American actor, because to me, there are equivalences between being a Jew in Germany and being African-American, I mean, Jew in Germany in the 30s and being an African-American in America today. They're not the same at all. But there are things that we can talk about in relation. And I had this idea, again, it might work, it might not. I would like Brecht, I have an idea of actually an Iranian actor. So I want somebody to come from a difficult country to another difficult country. And I have a young Iranian friend who I'm in my work and mentoring, so we're talking about people she knows and so on. And but I want to use it also in its interstices, like they live somehow in the interstices of two times and two spaces, and so I want it to be very real, like real neighborhoods of New York, but the intercutting is a little, there are some aspects of actually, I want footage from the 1930s, and I want it to show, and this is, I'm only learning about this, but it's really striking. I found a lot of footage, there is a lot of footage, of Nazis in the New York area in the 1930s. I was just showing Esther and Laura, like, huge Nazi rally. This is something that is not talked about, because people don't really like to think about it. And during the Second World War, of course, it was all shut down. But there was an enormous fascist following in America. You know, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion was just everywhere, promoted by Henry Ford and stuff like that. I mean, there was just a lot of bad shit going on. So it was there, and it's there again today, you know. It's not dead. These things don't. It was just kind of lying in wait. So these are some aspects of these times that I want to talk about. And I actually started, I'm going to show you. Can I show some?
Shall we just move from our chairs away so that we can see?
And just some still images I put together like 5 minutes before the